Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today we're going to be discussing President Trump's travel ban. I'm joined by a very special and one of our returning guests, Professor Christopher Isike. Professor Isike is Professor of African Politics and International Relations in the Department of Political Sciences, University of Pretoria, where he's also the director of the African Center for the Study of the United States, among many other roles. Chris, I'm very happy to welcome you back. I know last time we had you was a year ago when we discussed about the divided African stance on the Israel-Hamas war. So it's good to have you back, and I look forward to our conversation.
Yeah, thank you, Mike, for having me, and good to be back.
Brilliant. So let's start off during Trump's first term in 2017, I think 2016, between 2016 to 2020. So there was a controversial travel ban that targeted some African countries at the time, the Muslim-dominated countries at the time. So in Trump's 2.0, we've seen recently another travel ban where majority of the countries under the travel ban are from Africa. And there's also fear that there might be an expanded list covering more than two-thirds of African countries. What is behind this? What is the rationale behind this travel ban?
Well, look, it's not unexpected. You know, the Make America Great Again, which for me really is Make White American Men Great Again in America, and that tells you the racial ideation, behind let me not say racial, actually racist ideation behind Mr. Trump's MAGA. And MAGA aligns with the Project 2025, that is the playbook of the Trump administration, especially in his second term. So if you bear that in mind, then you begin to look at the countries that have been affected by these so-called bans, and then you see that they are countries with people of color, all of them, in fact, and that's where also Africa falls in. So it is a misconception rooted in a racist ideation of people of color not contributing, people of color problematic, not contributing to American greatness, and they're therefore looking for excuses to try and place these countries in his list of bans. He claims that some of these countries do not have proper systems in place to vet, passports and travel. Some of these countries, I hear that there's a consideration for a list of 36 countries, and many of these countries fall under reasons of countries where you have citizens from countries that do not return to those countries, right? So the excuse on paper is seeing them as measures to help protect Americans from dangerous foreign actors. That's the excuse they're giving, but if you dive deep into the reasons that is behind it, you will find that it is actually racism and nothing else.
So if we, how do you think, or how has Africa responded so far? Let's start from there. The affected countries, or Africa as a whole, the African Union, has they responded?
Well, I think it was more of the African Union, you know, that responded to say that these things should be judicious, should be fair, should follow international conventions and protocols on movement of people. But besides those, those kinds of statements, yeah, I think they are just statements. It's not very effective in changing anything about, you know, what the Trump administration has done.
But there are
a few countries that have indicated that they would reciprocate. We saw actions from Namibia, a country like Namibia. So there could be more following that path to say, well, we will reciprocate. Especially considering that Americans can come into several African countries without a visa. I do not understand why these countries cannot reciprocate and tell, let America know that if you put a visa regime in place for us, we'll also put for you. And of course, it will affect some of these countries more because of the disproportionate economic power relations between the United States and many countries in the continent. But at least it will showcase national pride, national interest, and that can force the regime to begin to look more closely on a case-by-case basis, because some of these bans are also just blankets without looking at what some of these countries bring to the U.S.
I think, again, the question will be how should, and you've touched on that. So we've seen Chad. I think Chad has put in place a visa ban on U.S. citizens. And then if you mentioned Namibia, in recent years, we've seen the Namibian president talking tough on basically the genocide committed by Germany in the past. And there's been heightened conversation about reparations. We see in the AES countries, we've seen all this kind of like, and in Senegal as well, we've seen some sort of consciousness among some African leaders that are taking a stand, talking about, you know, African pride, African whatever. Do you think this will help move that conversation and that kind of narrative? And would it shape the direction of African leaders to start looking inwards and looking at, would they have to evoke that Africanness and the need to look inwards and then build a system that works for Africa?
Look, the most effective way to deal with these kinds of problems is for us to look inwards at ourselves, like you have said, but look at ourselves in terms of how are we governing ourselves, and what kind of mechanisms, you know, trading mechanisms have we put in place? Look at the AFTA, for example. How are we implementing it? How are different governments in the continent making it easier for movement of people and goods and services across the continent? This is a trillion dollar market, market that's worth trillions of dollars, in fact. And I think that if we are able to look at ourselves and put systems in place to ensure that we trade with ourselves more often than we do, and then circulate our wealth within the continent, you will find that there will be less need for many Africans to even look to those countries like the US for greener pastures, right? And the second upside of that is that we will build a value chain that and a market that big economies like the US, like China, would be begging us to be part of. And we can then sit and decide the terms of including them or opening these markets to them. And I've said this before, that rather than us chase and beg the United States to have beneficiation through AGOA, we should actually turn our attention to the Africa Continental Free Trade Area Agreement, make it work, and do more business with ourselves. And very soon, it will be the other way around. It will be these countries, including the U.S., coming to lobby us to say how they can get in, especially if, again, as part of that looking inwards, Africa is able to develop a common position on how to engage with superpowers or great powers in the continent, who are again now contesting, scrambling amongst themselves for Africa's resources. So that for me is a better way, the long-term way to deal with this kind of thing. And I'm really pleased, recently I saw King's College in London, we had this project with the Afrexim Bank, and they've now launched the African Hospital in Specialist Hospital in Abuja. These are the kind of things that the continent should be doing, so that, for instance, if that is able to work effectively, the whole of West Africa, that hospital will become a medical tourism hub for the whole of West Africa. So we can have more of these kinds of hospitals across the continent. And those who go for medical tourism, medical reasons, will have no reason to begin to go. Who will lose? It will be the United States that will lose. And who will gain? It will be Africa that will gain from, you know, the income that comes from those kinds of tourism.
Speaking about that, there seems to be a bit of a paradox. So you mentioned the kind of what people call the third scramble for African resources. We've seen it in the Congo, but we've seen it in other places. But then if you place that in parallel to Trump's protectionist kind of nationalism, you see there seems to be a paradox again, considering that there seems to be that trade, that competition between China and Trump that led to the travel ban. There's also the trade tariffs. There's the tariffs that Trump slapped on almost every country in the world, but African countries also. Lesotho, a small country, was slapped with such tariff within that AGOA's kind of stuff. So if we look at all of that, what are the factors that have been holding Africa down? Are these factors internal? Or are they external to doing some of the things you've mentioned, trading among themselves, making African continental free trade a better place, ensuring free movement of goods? What are those factors? Are these internal or external?
Well, they are both. They are both internal and external. It would be naive to claim that the world, conspiracy against Africa to ensure that Africa is kept down, and you can see this in the kinds of terms of trade and conditionalities for loans that the Bretton Woods institutions use for Africa. These are specifically designed for only Africa, and make it possible for Africa to actually do anything meaningful. Apart from being trapped in a dependency on the West. But then the internal argument is also very strong, in the sense that no country is going to give you a free gift, a free lunch. You have to decide for yourself who you are, create what you want to do, and simply implement that. And over time, when people see consistency in your principles, in your character, in your behavior, they'll be forced to reckon with you and respect you. And I think that's a common basic way for Africa to begin to look at this thing. So if Africa was able to put structures in place to govern itself effectively, right? Minimize conflicts that emerge from human insecurities that litter the continent. And I can tell you, our security challenges in Africa are from a human domain. They come more from a human domain than from the traditional military security domain or state security domain. There are more people dying in Africa from HIV and AIDS, from even malaria, from disease, and suffering health insecurities, economic insecurities, and other social insecurities. There are more people dying from those kinds of human insecurities compared to those that die from war. Okay, there was a phase in the early 2000s where there was no conflict in Africa at all. Okay, and then if you look at it, most of our conflicts are, more than 90% of our conflicts are actually intrastate conflict. That's conflict that happened within state. And the bottom line of most of this conflict is poor governance and mismanagement of diversity Of course, that's also a governance challenge in itself. So if we're able to govern ourselves effectively, there'll be peace and security in the continent. And then there'll be room for us to begin to ask questions about these borders that divide us. You started by talking about protectionism. That are we? Is there not a contradiction if we're blaming the US for being protectionist and we ourselves end up being that? Well, the fact of the matter is that we're different, because in the first instance, we have no business, you know, having those borders and allowing those artificial borders to separate us. We should have a common economic zone, and there's nothing wrong in us trading within ourselves. It's not protectionism in any way. It is countries within a region trading within themselves and strengthening their own trading, bargaining, and market power. So that's what we should be doing, but we are always blinded by artificial borders that were put in place without our consent, without our participation in the definition of these borders and in the definition of the political communities that became from them. So I would say in a nutshell that is both external and internal, but we can begin to change the external dimension of our problems if we handle the internal ones ourselves, take responsibility for them, and begin to do better. And it actually starts with rethinking our state and governance systems, like I said in my previous engagement with you on Africa.
I agree with you. And just clear, I wasn't talking about protectionism from the African perspective. I was talking about the paradox in the United States having this protectionist policy, at the same time competing with China, and then the scramble for Africa. So I was talking from that angle, not from the angle of Africa. But in the immediate, what do you think is the implication of this ban? Will it have any kind of impact socially, economically, or politically? What kind of impact will it have in the short term to long term?
Well, in the short term, it will affect people who, who are planning to go for, for instance, mostly postgraduate education in the US. The US have some of the best universities in the world. And again, this is another paradox of some sort, because if you look at the top 10 universities in the world right now, the number one is an American university, Harvard, right? But the next nine are Chinese universities. But for some reason, everyone in the world prefers to go to America, including even the Chinese themselves. Okay, so there are over a million Chinese that go to the United States for postgraduate education. So, and that were affected by some of the travel bans and student restrictions on student visas, because you have to read them together. So I'm reading them together now. The travel bans and student visas. These bans have a short-term effect of preventing people who want to go for studies in the United States, who looking to go for conferences, academic conferences in the United States, and can't go anymore. And then also the countries involved would then be forced to a position where they would either have to engage with the U.S. on its terms, or take a radical approach based on national prestige or pride, like we saw Chad have done, and that can put them on a collision course with the United States, that can eventually make Trump to train his eyes on them and find ways to try and punish them. So that can then become a short to long term implication, depending on how fast Trump gets to it. As you know, Mr. Trump rules America based on his whims and caprices, shooting from the hips as he goes. So if someone whispers to his ears that there's a country called Chad that is challenging us, they shouldn't, he tweets about it, and his tweet becomes some kind of policy until it is challenged and reversed, by a court of law or superior logic that appeals to his ego. So for me, those are the short to long-term benefits. The fact that it affects people-to-people engagement between these countries and the United States, especially Africa. Africa has a rich history of African-American diaspora in the U.S. And many of them have connections to their home countries. Somalia is a good example, you know. So if these bans come into effect, it will hamper movement of people, the networks that have been created by some of these people in diaspora in America. But having said that, America would also feel the impact of this. If I'm to talk Africa specifically, among the great powers of the world that are competing among themselves now for dominance, America is the only one that has an African diaspora, okay? You don't have a huge African diaspora and that connects with the continent, you know, like, you know, with China or with Russia, for example. America has that. And that's a huge soft power advantage that America has in trying to, that it can use to win the, it's, you know, the scrabble with these other competitors in Africa. If it does what it's doing, and if it continues to treat Africa the way it's been treating it, there's a chance that it will lose that soft power. And as you know, great powers, world leaders, do not just become world leaders on account of just their military hard power. The soft power is an important component of maintaining that power. And right now, America is losing it as a result of some of these kinds of actions.
You mentioned Russia, you mentioned China as well. Does this, so we've seen it in the light of the anti-Western kind of narrative, anti-French in the Sahel. We've seen it in all of this space. We've seen Russia being entrenched in African policy, though people might say within the context of disinformation and all of that. But does this present an opportunity for these other Eastern powers to... Not just the superpowers, we should also say middle powers as well. You know, does this present an opportunity for them to fill in the gap? Or should Africa, like one of the guests said, that Peter, it looks like Africa is just substituting one master for another master, you know, going from, you know. So what do you think is best for Africa to do? Or does this present an opportunity for Russia and China to take hold in the continent? Or should Africa just, like some would say, Africa, it gives Africa the leverage to be able to deal with whoever it wants to deal with, and it gives them that the power of options or alternatives. What is your take on that?
Well, there are two questions you're asking here. The first one is, it gives an opportunity for other powers, including middle powers, you know, to take advantage of the gap that is left by the U.S. and its isolationism from the continent. And my answer is yes, that it does give them an opportunity, and many of them are taking these opportunities. You know, China, for example, agreed recently to give remove visa restrictions for all African countries to China, I think except Eswatini, and that's largely because they are the only country in Africa that recognize the independence statehood of Taiwan. So that's one way that countries like China are trying to fill in those gaps. You see China, Russia continue to make inroads into the continent, you know, signing deals. That's another way that they're taking advantage, and it's not just these two. Like you said, middle powers. Virtually every a country that is worth its salt in the world today, in the world economy, has some kind of a summit, a country Africa summit. You have Japan Africa summit. You have you know, Korea Africa summit. You know, Germany, the EU, all of these countries have some kind of summit and deal with Africa. But Africa doesn't have any kind of strategy and policy on how to engage with these competing powers and competing interests. And this goes to the second part of your question in terms of what Africa should do. I think that it's like a you know, a beautiful bride with so many suitors coming from all parts of the world, everyone wanting a piece of you. If you as that bride decide that you are going to go out with everyone and enjoy everyone, at the end of the day, you may end up not getting married to anyone because every one of them would have had access to you one way or another, and that would diminish your value. But if you say, okay, as I'm engaging and meeting everyone, I have a plan, I have a strategy of what I want, and in so doing, as I meet with every one of them, I will eventually pick the one that I want and manage the rest, right? That's the kind of attitude that Africa should have. Unfortunately for us, we do not have that plan. So we don't have a common African position on how to deal with great powers broadly. There is none specifically for the United States, none for China, none for Russia. So I'm talking about like an Africa-US policy or an Africa-China policy or Africa-Russia, Africa-Japan policy. We don't have. At the least, we should at the African Union level have a broad common African position on how to deal with great powers. And anyone that fall under that rubric will be managed by that policy and everyone will be bound by it. But how can we even have that when we have 54 states with 54 foreign policies and many of them contradicting themselves and looking out for specific national interests that may benefit them in the short term but may not in the long term? So this is why I'm saying that we need to find a way to have, so apart from having that common African position, and the African Union has been developing a lot of common African position on issues, global issues of the world, right? There are many of them, and commend them for those, but we don't have one on how to deal with great powers. But beyond doing that, the next recommendation that I'm making, this is based on research that I've done, published in Asian and African Studies in the US, is what I call the group hegemonic leadership. Since we don't have a hegemon in the liberal sense of the concept in Africa, you can't find it in Nigeria, you can't find it in South Africa or Egypt, what can happen is for them to come together in what is referred to as cooperative hegemony, where different leaders in the different sub-regions can come together and operate a group leadership that speaks on behalf of the continent on major issues that will be agreed to by all. And if your next question is going to be how that will work in terms of which countries to choose, my recommendation is that it can be rotated every 5 or so years between different countries from different sub-regions until every single country is represented. That will give you the kind of legitimacy that it needs to be able to trust the decisions and the actions that will be taken by this hegemonic leadership group on behalf of the continent. For me, if we don't do that, we will be cherry-picked by these countries that are coming and using the usual tactics of divide and rule to try and get as much as they can from us.
I want to see. I've seen a little bit of some problem in that proposal, and you've mentioned some of it before. So very, very strangely, you mentioned about the imposed borders, the European, forced borders that were implemented in Africa. But surprisingly or shockingly, Africa has defended those borders, and there's never been, like you rightly said, what we've had most in Africa, we've had intrastate conflicts rather than interstate conflicts. It's very rare where you see interstate conflict, where those borders have been challenged, where we're talking about reconstructing this channel, taking them back to its original form. So if you look at that, is on one end. So on the second end, we talk about the AU itself and look about how the AU is largely externally funded and how when you're talking about hegemon, again, that's another aspect. Then another third aspect in terms of what you've proposed with, rotating the whatever. So hegemon also has to do with what leverage you have as a country. So it could be in terms of maybe you mentioned Nigeria, Egypt, and South Africa, maybe in terms of your economy, maybe in terms of your armies, maybe in terms of all of this stuff. So if you look at all of this, how do you deal with, and I know you mentioned the rotation to then kick against or to prevent that kind of what we have with the Security Council and the rest of the world, where only a few is captured power and detect whatever. That's what we talk about. But is that realistic in terms of what we talk about when we use the word hegemony? So how do we look at an organization that is externally funded? How can that organization then be the right one? Or how can it challenge the great powers that are funding it? Because they say he that pays the piper dictates the taste, the tone. So how does all of these ironies or other things, how can all of these be addressed to achieve that common unified response that you've mentioned? Because we've seen with AES, we've seen with there are some voices in Africa that are calling for this. We've seen with Namibia, we've seen with Namibian leaders and all of that. But how can we have all of this against all of this background?
So let me start with the last part of the question that talks about, you know, hegemony in its liberal sense. If you recall, I said in the liberal sense of it, we don't have a hegemon in the continent, but we have regional leaders in the continent that provide public goods and underwrite costs for these public goods on behalf of the rest, at least even at the regional level. Now, my starting point is that even the whole idea of common African position is based on a historization of Africa's engagement with itself. That historicism is rooted in our common colonial experience, okay, and our experience the colonial state as it was formed. So the point I'm trying to make is that we do not need to use Western concepts that apply to Western experiences to define how we organize ourselves structurally as a people. We have enough in Africa that will show you that what I'm talking about existed in pre-colonial Africa before colonialism. We have experience of these kinds of engagement. I'm doing a handbook for De Gruyter now on Africa's foreign policy and diplomacy, and a part of that book looks precisely at this question of how Africa engaged itself, how it organized itself, you know, in terms of international relations with itself. And some of the principles, these principles are still useful in developing, concept. And this idea of group hegemony has been used in different parts of the world before. And that's where Pedersen, for instance, developed what he called cooperative hegemony. And I call it group hegemony now, but trying to contextualize it within the African space. So the point I'm trying to make is that if you have a group of people, and this is the second basis of our common African position, is our worldview as Africans, okay? As Africans, we are a people that believe in the worldview of communalism, not communism, communalism, the idea of Ubuntu, that I am because you are. We understand that we our worldview is that of, you know, the individual subordinating his or her interests to the collective. So we believe in collectivism as a worldview. And that means we believe as Africans that the head is only as strong as the hand. And the hand is only as strong as the leg and the ear and the nose, and all of them form a compact. This is a worldview that is different from the Cartesian worldview of individualism that defines the conception of the world as a rat race where the strongest person should dominate, where might is right, as we are currently seeing in the contradiction, the hypocrisy of Israel attacking Iran and then be surprised that Iran is responding in the same manner, right? Even though maybe not exactly equal. So the point I'm trying to make is that we have to, as Africans, develop concepts based on our experiences, based on our worldview that will work for us. And some of these countries that we say may not have the economic weight to be able to bring something on the table, sorry, to be able to put something on the table, they do have something to offer. Many of these countries have resources, okay, material resources on the ground. Many of them have markets that can be useful. Lesotho is a very small and poor country fall under Trump's ban? Actually, got the highest tariff. Why? All they do is to supply jeans material to the United States. Right, it's a small country. You would never have known that it could offer such value to the United States. So imagine if that was now turned back to the continent,
Africa.
Considering the population in Africa, the African market is bigger for Lesotho than the
US market.
American market. So if you give an incentive to why these countries should participate, and in the spirit of Africanness, where we say every part is important, and we actually implement that, you will see eventually that it's not only just about looking at hard power from the economic or military point of view, but it's also looking at the contributions that every single part makes to the whole. And this is how Africans see and think of itself. So if we're able to practice that for a while, it will be something that the world will eventually learn from us. And many of the world, many parts of the world are beginning to see the interconnected nature of the world, which many didn't see before until COVID. COVID underscored that point, helped drive it home. But the fear is that we have not done anything to try and advance this. And it comes largely from our weaknesses, the weaknesses of our individual state. And I'm saying that as individual states, we will not be able to cut it. But if we come together and agree, like the United States of Africa, where we give certain powers, and this is the long-term goal for me. Some of the things I've said are things that can happen now, but the real long-term goal is for us to now disband these entities we call states and have a much more United States of Africa, where foreign relations, trade will be discussed or will be handled by the Confederacy, if you like. And then things like education, cultural development, and others can be left in the the jurisdiction of what we call the current states, but which for me will either be called states or provinces of that larger United States of Africa. This is the dream that Kwame Nkrumah had for the continent. It is still feasible. It's still our best bet for dealing with the rest of the world as we currently are.
Let me come to the last question. I like the idea of what you're talking about as well, maybe Pan-Africanism. I think that's another topic that demand another episode on its own. So let's say, come to the last question. Considering Africa's growing power in international, like you rightly said, every country is caught in Africa. You know, you have Russia-Africa summit, America-Africa, because, you know, they're recognizing the power Africa holds in some of these geopolitical organizations, maybe the United Nations or even the way Africa's vote also makes some sense, besides, you know, the resources we own. How can Africa, in that collective sense, exert, I wouldn't say revenge, but it's part of diplomacy, if you prove that they can respond to it, I can respond diplomatically or legally to such a blanket ban. Can Africa use this power, use leverage to just what we've seen in the Sahel, where, you know, with Niger and all of that? How can Africa do that in a legal way to exact, you know, to one, redeem its image in a way, and to also tell the world, make a statement, a political statement that, you know, you can't treat us this way. We actually have something to offer. We can conclude with that.
Well, look, under international law, particularly the principle of state sovereignty, countries have the inherent right to regulate admissions of citizens and non-citizens into their country, right? So this gives them the authority to impose travel bans or restrictions based on considerations such as national security, and public health, for instance, right? So and this is the so every country has the right to do that. So we can't really begin to talk about a collective approach to try and respond to Trump's travel ban, because at the end of the day, every country has the right to do that, and it will be on a country to country basis, because these bans were not given to the African Union per se. It was given to specific countries. So my thinking is that these countries, if they choose to maintain relations with the U.S., can engage with the U.S. State Department and try and get their names off by, you know, tightening, movement, passport control, and passport security and things like that. Because those are some of the things that have been cited. There are some of these countries where it is very easy for people to leave the country on a fake passport, and even when they are deported, they can go back to the same country because of very loose regulations around immigration. So countries will have to engage in that. I think what just needs to happen is like the African Union has said, it can speak for the continent, and I think that that's where it should stop. Urge the U.S. And prevail on the U.S. to ensure that such measures align with international legal standards, ensuring that they are lawful and proportionate and non-discriminatory. And this is the area where we have a problem. So each individual country can evaluate their relationship with the United States and take specific actions at the United States. But it is something that the African Union should keep engaging with in any multilateral forum with the U.S. to say that we do not take kindly to the fact that you are treating a country in Africa in this sort of way. We find some of these bans actually discriminatory. The African Union can engage at that level with the U.S. through the African Union Commission, but every country should have a responsibility to try and respond in the way that works best for it.
Yeah, thank you very much, Chris. I really appreciate it as usual. This has been very rich conversation. And yes, we're really, really grateful. And I know, you're pressed for time. You have another engagement you're going to. So I would let you go. And thank you very much. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Mike.
Thank you very much for joining us this weekend. Another episode, a Zidane episode with Professor Chris Isike to discuss President Trump's controversial ban, where it seems African countries seems to be the majority in that ban list. As usual, join me to thank our guest, Professor Chris Isike, a very good friend and colleague. And I'll see you next week.